once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, on this Saturday, June 3rd, 2017. And you're welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400.
You sound like you're kind of losing energy there. Is that?
I could say 254-773-1400.
No, you're raising your energy level.
Right.
So that, or you've got some helium over there. And, yeah.
Okay. Well, there's other news besides the fact that the market went up. I mean, you could be you know what's amazing? Well, wait a minute. We have a telephone call. That's pretty amazing by itself.
Yeah.
So we'll wait for the amazing news on the other side of the telephone call. So, caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I've got a quick question. I'd like to transfer my S&P 500 to my my grandkids and kids.
You own the entire S&P 500?
Yes.
That's pretty impressive. Anyway, go ahead. You want to transfer it to your grandkids?
And I was wondering the tax implications and if there's any times of the year I should do it versus other times of the year.
All right. There's a simple answer and a complex answer.
I love it when he does that.
The simple answer is yes.
You can do it.
The complex answer is it's difficult. The number one thing is the tax implications. You need to be working hand in glove, or as I prefer, hand in shoe with a CPA, maybe even with an estate attorney to do this. Why estate attorney?
Well, a lot depends on how much you're trying to transfer.
Right. How much? Well, he said the S&P 500, and so I'm thinking many trillions of dollars. So how large of your S&P 500 holdings are moving over?
A couple hundred thousand.
If you do it slowly over time and you stay under the gift tax limits, which are
about $14,000 per person,
yeah,
you don't even have to do anything really all that special.
In other words, if you give them $14,000 a year, and you for example, you could establish a Uniform Gift to Minors Act account, and if wherever it is that you
how old are the minors? How old are they? Are the grandkids?
12.
Oh, okay. You could establish Uniform Gift to Minors Act account at whatever brokerage you're using to hold your S&P 500 shares. And I presume that you have a mutual fund or something. Is that correct?
No, I don't.
If you own the S&P 500, do you own 500 stocks, or do you own a mutual fund?
Is it an ETF? Or?
No, the rest of it's in cash.
Okay. The other side of this, there's this rather simple. You have a gift tax and estate tax exclusion that this year is about $5.4 million. Is your estate worth $5.4 million?
I wish.
Okay, so you can file, if you want to do it one time this year, it removes that money permanently from your exemption at the 5.4. So if you're giving $200,000 away, it goes to 5.2 forever after. And that's revised upwards with
inflation.
But
you do have to file a gift tax. Now
Okay,
I want to get something straight. You said it's in cash. So then you're not transferring the S&P 500 shares to mutual fund shares to your grandkids. Are you buying shares for them?
I'm eventually going to give them the cash, but the S&P 500 I thought I could just transfer the whole thing to them at one.
Well, yeah. If you are able to do that, you need to let me know how, because I would love the entire S&P 500.
No, what you start. So you have somewhere, you have either ETFs or mutual funds that are S&P 500
ish.
Oh, I have them with USAA.
Okay. What you do is you, as long as it's less than $14,000, you don't even have to file a gift tax return.
Do you have a spouse?
Do I have a what?
A spouse.
No.
Okay.
Well, then it's $14,000 per kid per year. You don't have to file an income tax return or a gift tax return. You can give more, and it probably will have no long-term effect on your estates unless you're going to be over $5 million in your estate.
But if you are giving more than the $14,000, then you do need to let your tax preparer know that that's going on, because there's a special form that needs to be filled out to let them know that you're aware that if it was a true gift above that amount, you would either have to pay the taxes or remove it from your exemption.
And there's basically a generation skipping tax that's involved there that you don't have to pay until you die, but you won't have to pay it at all because you don't have enough money in your estate. So it's just a matter of filling out the right paperwork. If you don't fill out the right paperwork on your tax return, you can be fined for failure to file a gift tax return.
Which is absurd, but that's what we were talking about last hour. Things are absurdly complex in the tax world.
And, you know, if you give them $14,000 apiece per year, I don't know, it will take a while to get up to the $200,000 level. But, and then what you do is you put in your will or you put in the whatever, that the rest of it transfers. If you don't make it to the $200,000, the rest of it transfers at that point.
And you can leave it in your will to transfer it directly at that point.
Yeah.
And at that point, there's not even an extra tax form for it, except that your executor is going to have to file your income taxes.
And
but you don't get to enjoy the gift at that point. You only get to enjoy it now, maybe looking down from on high, hopefully looking down from on high to see them receive it.
You know, there's the answer very simply. You can give up to $14,000 to anybody in any year without doing anything other than just transfer. By the way, I wouldn't recommend you sell the shares and send it to them, because then you've got to pay taxes on the gains in there. You just do, you set up a, the easiest way to do it in your case is set up a Uniform Gift to Minors Act account at USAA where you have the shares, and instruct USAA.
It's Uniform Transfer to Minors.
I'm sorry, Uniform Transfer. The gift is eight. Yeah,
it's a much
18
older
and 21.
One. It's an older one. They don't do that
so
one.
So Uniform Transfer to Minors Act, UTMA account at USAA, and say, I want to transfer this much value. You tell USAA, I want to transfer $14,000 into this account and $14,000 into that account. Or, again, after consulting with whoever does your taxes or looking in TurboTax and figure out what you're doing, you could say, I want to transfer $100,000 to each of them. And you could do that. And I would, you know, and what will happen from that moment forward is any taxes that are due on those accounts will be required to be paid by those minors, which means they're going to need to file income tax returns thereafter. It makes life a little more interesting that way.
Okay. One other question. Is it 14,000 or 14,000 and above that you can't? Or up to 14,000.
Up to 14,000, no tax return needs to be filed.
I highly advise you to recommend in all areas tax related. This is something broad and that we can give specific advice on. Work with the tax preparer that does it for a living, preferably a CPA.
Yeah. And
okay. Well, thank you very much. You've been a big help.
Well, thank you for calling.
Have a great day.
Okay.
You too.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. 254-773-1400. We don't give tax advice. That wasn't advice. That was education, just in case you thought it might have been advice, because we ended it with talk to a professional tax preparer, you know, one of those kinds of people, just like we don't give legal advice. And
talk to a professional lawyer. Wait, do they come professionally?
I don't know.
Okay.
We have another call on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning. This is Paul from Temple.
Hello,
morning,
Paul Von Temple.
How are you doing, sir?
Oh, we're here.
Sirs. Let me put an S on the end of that.
There's a S at the beginning and the end, yes.
And the end, yes, right. It's you can almost turn it backwards, but then it becomes Sirs.
Yes.
Sirs.
I think that may be how they named the AI at Apple. It's
serious.
Could be.
Yes,
could be.
Okay.
Research that and bring it back to us next
okay.
Week. This is something that we wouldn't have asked about probably 10 or 15 years ago, but I used to work in the fertilizer business, and we toyed around with deciding whether we wanted to go after the pot market, the marijuana market. Now, as it's continuing to grow, whether we like it or not, are there mutual funds that that basically invest strictly in marijuana-related businesses?
Yeah, but they're in Canada.
There are no Investment Company Act of 1940 mutual funds. There are no American mutual funds. It's still against federal law.
There's some Canadian funds that are equivalent of our mutual funds, and they're backed by similar laws and protections, but you have to convert to Canadian dollars and buy their shares on an exchange in Canada, because otherwise you would be guilty of interstate funding of a criminal activity, which would
it's
be
a federal.
Which
even if it's an ancillary business, like, you know, there's growing mediums, there's growing lights, there's all kinds of ancillary things.
Yeah,
but you said the magic word. You said marijuana, and marijuana is more restricted than heroin.
Yeah.
By law. Yeah. So you said the magic word, and it's on the air, and it's been taped now. So anything that you buy that has anything to do with any medium,
you're being paranoid.
I know. I am paranoid.
There are a lot of ways to invest in the ancillary businesses. There's ways of investing in any kind of like hydroponics manufacturing, the grow mediums, the tanks, and the grow lights, and all of that. But the reality is that with kind of on-demand creation of that stuff, a lot of it's being made in China. A lot of it is relatively inexpensive stuff. There are ways to get around parts of that, but in the states where it is legal, they have their own pools of money. But the problem with it is that it's really hard to be profitable in there for the same reason. Well, this is important because it's federal. Those companies that are growing and they get their profits from growing are not allowed to deduct any expenses, zero expenses on their taxes. If you've got a business and you buy a bunch of material to sell it, well, you can write the material off because you went around and just immediately sold it. You don't have to take the price of it as part of the income. Your expenses are not taken out of the income on the federal tax return. If it is, it's fraud. And the IRS, by the way, asks you, this is quite fantastic stuff. All income must be reported to the IRS or it's a separate law violation. There's in the tax code, it talks about illegally gotten goods, from prostitution to bribery to even if you're doing barter exchange in a bribery case, if you don't report the value of that, whatever it was that was bartered, as income, then you've broken a separate law. And you're not allowed to write off any of the expenses.
There's a couple of things you can do. And if you just Google this, I'm not going to tell you the ones. But there was an article in Forbes this year about marijuana stocks that you can buy legally in the United States. Quite seriously, there aren't any mutual funds, to the best of my knowledge, that trade specifically in that area, because they would immediately be investigated by the DEA or something. We have a really dysfunctional issue going here.
Yeah, when now 40 states have some law legalizing its use, and the federal law says it's not legal. So there's an issue there. Our state has a law dealing with it. It's a law that cannot be used appropriately yet. And even this session, when several of those laws got to the floor, they weren't voted on. So we have an inoperable law right now.
This is the point, though. Every stock, according to that Forbes article, every stock that you could buy that had something to do with the marijuana industry is a company that is losing money at a fairly rapid rate.
Does it has to, and because it's not able to deduct any expenses.
So you've got... It'd be wonderful if we could say, okay, eventually marijuana is going to be legal, and when marijuana is legal, there's going to be a lot of money made there. The probabilities are that none of the companies that are currently trading in stocks in marijuana will be the ones that make the money. The big pharmaceutical companies will probably make a lot of money on it. It isn't. I mean, if it was that easy, a lot of people would be doing it. Now, there are some stocks that trade on the Canadian exchanges that in some cases they have ADRs in the United States, but the best way to get to them is if you really, really thought marijuana was cool. Canada is about to make marijuana legal, and once it makes marijuana legal, there will probably be some place in Canada where somebody will open up the equivalent of a mutual fund. It's going to be a real pain, And you're not the only person doing it. And people have bid these stocks up real high because it's kind of like the dot-com stocks when the internet first started.
Yeah, there is one specific dot-com stock that I really think is a good example here. DR Coop, which was based in Austin. And it was a really good idea. I basically said that they would take prescription. They would be an online pharmacy. So the doctor would send the prescription, and then they would mail it to the patient. The problem with it was is it wasn't legal. You couldn't send a controlled substance through the mail. That law has since been changed, but it took them about 12 years to change the law, and in that time, DR Coop disappeared, because basically what the CEO would say in speeches and so on, and this is a thing that I remember very clearly. We were in Manhattan for an interview with Bloomberg over Old Baldy's here's book, and this was back in, I think it was around 2000.
1846.
And DR Coop, the CEO, was on the air immediately after being interviewed, and basically what he said is, this business will be eminently profitable. We're lobbying Congress. As soon as the law is passed, we'll be able to make money hand over fist. Their price went up and up and up. Basically what he just said was that the only way we will be profitable is through an act of Congress. Well, that's what we're talking about with the American marijuana industry right now. There are ways of being profitable in the state if you have a markup on the marijuana of an operating margin on a typical business is around, if it's really nice, it's 10%. In the marijuana world, it's got to be closer to 50% in order to make profit. And with the kind of competition, a lot of people and their uncles and cousins are all getting into this in those states. So they're all trying to say, well, we're just going to try to get market share until the law changes. But we don't know when that's going to be. And a lot of them are going to fail between now and then, because they can't wait long enough. They can't lose money every year and stay around.
And I have heard a lot of people who've said, man, I want to find some way to invest in marijuana because it's going to be the big thing of the future. I think that's a reasonable probability. However, you're going to have to see both Congress and the president.
And the states.
Well,
Texas,
right,
in this particular case, still says it's illegal. So even if the Fed changes the Federal Reserve, if the federal government changes it, the state won't.
From a investment point of view, it's kind of like you can invest in Coors when it was illegal to sell in Texas.
Right.
Right now, the DEA makes a lot of money off marijuana, because every time they seize marijuana, they can seize the property associated with it, and it makes them a lot of money, and that's what they run the show off of. And Republicans have a minority of people who list themselves as Republican who favor legalization of marijuana. So the chances of Congress lowering the status of marijuana from 1 to 2, 1 means you can't do clinical tests.
Without a specific license, right, from the DEA.
But the point is, well, they won't even on a class one. I think it's a class one. No, it's called
Schedule One. And yes, there
you can't even get. But the point
you
is,
you can get licenses. They gave 117 licenses last year.
But the Congress keeps wanting large scale studies. This is what the committees keep coming up with before they'll consider moving it to a Schedule Two.
Right. And
but they can't have large scale studies as long as it's a Schedule One, so they don't have to worry about it.
All
so
of the
it's
studies.
It's going to be quite a while before marijuana becomes legal in the United States.
This is another silly point. All of the studies have to use government approved marijuana, which is only grown at the University of Georgia. There's only one facility that grows United States government approved marijuana. Any large scale study has to use that marijuana, which means that even if you get a license, it could be 5 years before you start the study, because you got to get in line behind everybody else. And most of the studies are given preferential treatment if they deal with addiction.
So
it's not medical.
If at the next presidential election, the House, the Senate, and the President goes Democrat and goes left Democrat, there's a possibility that marijuana could become legal at some point several years thereafter.
But as we all know, politics is very predictable. No, that was sarcasm.
So it's not likely to happen anytime in the near future. Well, and I'll tell you something. You can, if you want to speculate in something. Do you realize that there are bonds out there, municipal bonds, backed by the full faith and credit of a sovereign state within the United States that currently are yielding like 6%?
It's Illinois, isn't it?
Yeah.
they're almost junk bond status.
Well, Illinois just got downgraded this week by S&P to one notch above junk bond status.
This Moody's just downgraded China, too. So there's lots of downgrades happening in big areas.
But we may very well see if by July 1st, Illinois doesn't pass a budget, and it's an impasse between the Republicans and the Democrats.
An impasse of a pass a budget?
Right. Well, an impasse by definition, no pass. Then S&P said they're going to do the first downgrade of a state within the United States to junk status. And despite the fact that it's back, in other words, at that point, Illinois will be coasting into bankruptcy, which will be big headline news if it happens. And at present, the Republicans and the Democrats appear to be unwilling to compromise on anything. And as a result, there's a pretty fair chance that the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago will go into bankruptcy.
Which is, you know, we didn't even have the tools to have a sovereign state go into bankruptcy before. So thank you, Puerto Rico, for helping us develop the tools.
Well, only partway there. See, it's a special bill in Congress.
Right. We'll get this all figured out, and then just in time for Illinois to use it.
To give you an example, there's a 2007 30-year municipal bond, which matures in 2037, issued to refinance everything in that Chicago, Illinois had borrowed at a lower rate, and the lowest rate they could go. So the coupon on it is 5.25%.
And that's scary.
I was just looking at sales. This bond is now 10 years old, and it has a coupon on it of 5.25%, which income tax free, 5.25%. What a deal!
Except
that the sales last week, there was a sale of at 93.625, and of course there's a commission on it, so it's about 93. So somebody took a 7% loss.
Let me take this from a perspective. A lot of times when we talk about interest rates on bonds, it gets into an area that people have no clue what we mean. Interest rates on bond, when you use a credit card, it's like Illinois issuing a bond, and you have a choice of credit cards. Say you have three credit cards available, and one of them will give you money at 1%, one of them will give you money at 5%, and one of them will give you money at 27%. Which one are you going to choose? Well, if you have the 1%, that's the one most people, if they're thinking about it, instead of just grabbing it from the wallet. And hopefully the folks, the government of Illinois is very carefully analyzing which funding to get. They say, okay, we'll use the lowest rate available. Well, if there are a lot of people lined up to give you credit cards, you're going to have a lot of options, and a lot of them are going to be low interest rates. If your credit's not good, you're not going to have a lot of options. And all the options you will have is a high interest rate. The banks look at that, and they see it as a risk with some possibility of return, which is why it goes up to 27% in a lot of cases. Sometimes 29.99% is being charged on a credit card because they think we better get the money back now because they're never going to pay this off. Well, that's approaching what we're seeing from the investment world for Illinois. If they're giving us 5% plus, and it's income tax free, if you think of that as a corporate bond, it would be something like a 7 or 8% interest rate because you've got to pay taxes on that interest. So it's a huge interest rate that a municipality is being charged to borrow money because they need the money.
And it's sort of going to be interesting up there. That's looking down the road towards what's happening in that.
We've got some commercials to play if you'd like to.
Let's do commercials.
Let's do that. We'll be back on the other side. Today is June 3rd. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us, this is the second hour of a two-hour program, so now's a good time. 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Ooh. Oh.
They are not on the air.
Hey, something interesting happened. There's a lot of noise being made about, and I think most of it is hysterical, about the decision by the president to renegotiate the Paris Accords.
Not renegotiate. He just got out of it.
He just pulled out. I thought he was going to renegotiate. Anyway.
No, he's that's already signed by everyone but us.
There's only 195 signatures.
Nicaragua and Syria.
Anyway, it probably will be bad for business in some ways, and that's the big effect. I don't think it's going to have a profound effect on carbon emissions, because we're already on track to lower them anyway because of economics. I got something I want to say here. Coal stocks fell on the announcement.
No big surprise there. It doesn't make it less expensive than natural gas.
The reason coal stocks fell is there's concern that exports of coal stocks will go down, of coal will go down, because we're not part of the agreement.
Right. We've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, I have an IRA that I inherited, and it is with a large investment firm, and I have to decide if I want it to be grandfathered or if it will go into where the firm is more the fiduciary, a fee-based IRA. And I wanted to know what your opinion was on leaving it grandfathered the way it is, or moving it to a fee-based fiduciary account.
All right. Boy, that's a big question with as little data as you have.
Yeah.
A
fee-based fiduciary account, there's a change in the regulations that is being delayed. It's been delayed a lot of times. It was a regulation that was imposed by the Pension Protection Act of 2006. It was supposed to come out in January and then in April, and now it's been delayed back to, I think it's in August.
June 9th.
June 9th, okay. So June 9th, it goes into...
June 9th is when I have to make my decision.
Yeah, and it goes into effect on that date, right.
What it says is that anyone that's giving advice on an IRA or any type of retirement vehicle has to act in your best interest and fully disclose to you all fees, all conflicts of interest.
Unless it's grandfathered,
and then it's just treated as it's always been, which means that the internal expenses, it's up to you to figure out what they are. If you have an annual fee type situation, then they need to be earning it. It can't be something that they just say, okay, we're going to put it over here and not look at it anymore.
How big is this IRA that you inherited? How many dollars?
It's right at 2,000. I mean, 200,000.
200. Oh, well, there's a difference there.
Yeah.
They're all zeros. I mean,
zeros don't really mean anything, right? They're just nothing.
Do you have an investment advisory or brokerage firm or something that you work with personally?
I do not. Everything that I have inherited is through this place, and I was actually going to see if I could make an appointment to come in and talk to you all, because I think I need to do that.
Okay. Well, the key is to get someone to explain that to you in detail and to
Gather the data, because there's a lot of information that's missing there.
And really, it's up to you to understand this. Right now, it apparently, I'm just guessing from what you've said, if it's going to be grandfathered, it's in a commission account where the broker who does stuff in there gets a commission when there's trades.
Yes,
moving it to a fee at 200,000, I think if your fees are low, that would probably be the fee based thing would probably be a better way, may be a better way to do it. I can't say without looking at it. But the point is, don't go from let's just say it's static and you're not paying any commissions, to a position where you're paying 1.5% or 2% a year to have it sit there and do nothing.
I would say go ahead and call our office.
Yeah.
You can get voicemail there during the weekend. Just leave your name and number, say you called the program, and we'll talk to you about it. And even if you stay where you are with the money, we'll look it over and say there's some things that you need to understand about it, particularly in cases with inheritance, because it's not often a well-discussed area with the people that had the assets before of what to do with it and what it all means and why it's there. So figuring it out and then defining what you want out of it is pretty vital. And if it's just being managed by a fiduciary that doesn't take the time to sit down and talk to you, then that's not really a fiduciary relationship.
And right now there have not been very many fees charged because it has just been kind of static. And it's been a well-producing account. But since my mom was already taking the required
minimum distributions,
whatever they are,
required minimum distributions,
Now I have to start taking them.
Now, you say there were no fees being charged. Let me say, yes, there were fees being charged. They were just invisible, which is what this is all about. Is making them visible unless they're grandfathered. The grandfather, they don't have to tell you what they're charging you, and it's charged in the background, and they get paid in the background, and you
it's
don't kind of see it.
Ignorance is bliss. You don't know what you're paying for, so you don't know how much you're paying.
If they go to a fee-based account, then they have to tell you all that stuff, which they
and
will tell
if
you.
If we go to a fee-based account, I think it's a 1.3%, and that's what I asked him. I said, well, tell me what it would have been last year if it were fee-based versus what it was if it was grandfathered, and he couldn't tell me.
That's not a good sign.
That's really a bad sign.
That's what I didn't think. I mean, when I first got the letter, I thought, oh, no, I've been listening to the personal wealth coach, and I need it to not be grandfathered so that I know up front what is going on.
I think you just made the best statement you can possibly make, and that is you need to understand what's going on, and you need to have work with somebody somewhere who can answer those questions you have, or if they can't answer them when you ask them at that moment, at least can get back to you and say, here are the figures. Here's what we charged you last year, including all the internal fees and external fees and subordinate fees and ultra subordinate fees. If they can't tell you,
then they don't know.
They probably don't know, and it's probably high enough that if they were told, they'd be scared too.
Yeah. Well, and when I asked him his opinion, he said, well, this account is doing very well, and I would just suggest we do this and leave it grandfathered. And I thought, I don't know about that. Okay.
And, you know, and he could be completely correct, and when we look at it, hey, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Don't do anything with it. That's the nice thing about dealing with a real fiduciary is that if it is the greatest thing since sliced bread,
they're required to tell you. Here's the thing. At this point, he's not acting as a fiduciary. So when he makes the recommendation to stay where you are, it's not in your best interest necessarily. So it needs to be clear from the beginning.
I'm going to call your office, and I certainly appreciate your program. You all are very, very informative.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much. My headphones just broke a little bit. Got bigger.
Right.
All right. I will call your office, okay?
Thank you all. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for the call.
What I was talking about is the really fascinating thing, the purpose in – at least according to the president and according to the reports from other places, is that if we back out of the Paris Accords, coal will come back and we'll hire more people in coal.
Right.
Except for the fact that the markets – I love watching markets react to things. They don't react to things the way I would think they would sometimes, and they sometimes react to things in ways I never thought they would. In this case, the stock market said, whoops, if we're not part of the Paris Accords –
nobody's going to buy coal from
us. We're going to sell less coal.
And here, this is.
I thought that was pretty. I just thought it was pretty fascinating.
I had really debated with myself about talking about that. I do talk to myself sometimes. I debated with myself whether or not I wanted to bring this up, but I'm going to do it. The Paris Accords were signed. A lot of people signed them. A lot of countries signed them. the promises that they signed up to do, there's not a single country on track to meeting their promises.
Right. It's just a, hey, we all agree that we ought to be worried about something.
Yeah, it's a, let's stand together in the same room and say, yeah, we all agree. Let me make that as clear as possible. The Paris Accords, the most clearly stated thing is that the government of any of our nation and most of the other nations that we're talking about here are not responsible for the emissions that they're committing to lower. The corporations are, and corporations are funded by the marketplace, and the marketplace is saying, hey, particularly if it's not that expensive to get clean energy, you probably should do it. And that's the real reason our emissions have been falling for about 5 years. And that they had a peak after the recession was over. And since then, just the technology and fracking natural gases out there, solar is getting better, we're getting better batteries. There's a lot of things that are happening to cause our emissions to drop. And it has absolutely nothing to do with a piece of paper that was signed by any president. It has to do with the fact that the marketplace is demanding cheaper alternatives to the really smoky stuff. I mean, we used to put lead in our gasoline. It took the government saying, hey, don't do that anymore. But it would have happened eventually. Enough lawsuits against companies for babies being born strangely would cause the lead to leave. This is one of those things very clearly written up in a way, or not written up, very clearly stated. There's no law in the United States requiring airbags on all cars manufactured in the United States. There's no federal law. And yet the market has demanded it.
And
so that's the way it should go with the clean air and so on.
I personally don't think it was a good idea to back out of the agreement.
I don't
except
either.
For political reasons.
Yeah.
For a very simple reason. China and Europe right now are making deals to exchange coal, and we got cut out of the deal.
Yeah. Basically, this falls right into the Trans-Pacific Partnership and so on. By stepping out of the deal, it didn't make the deal stop. It just means the rest of the world is going to be profitable with each other and not with us. I think it's a bad step.
There's I got another thing I want to talk about.
I got lots of stuff too. So go ahead, you.
During the run up to through 2007, before the 2008, 2009 Great Recession, I don't know what was great about it, but
it wasn't that great if you ask me.
Financial, there was a concern among economists, very legitimate concern, that manufacturing wasn't doing all that well, and the rest of the economy was doing okay, but financial stocks were going through the stratosphere. Financial companies like Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo and Bank of America and Merrill Lynch were making money hand over fist and had huge profits. And of course, what they were doing is they were trading around bonds, mainly mortgage bonds, and they were repackaging them and selling them and then repackaging
and
the repackaged ones.
Every time it got sold,
yeah,
they got paid a commission.
Yeah.
And every time they bought it from someone else got paid a commission.
Well, the reverse is going on in the economy today. And it's a little bit satisfying. As a matter of fact, the article in the Wall Street Journal noted that financial stocks, bank stocks, are approaching bear market territory from their highs back in March. They're down anywhere from 14 to 16%. 20% down means they're in bear market territory. They are lowering their future forecasts. They are basically very worried about their financial future. Their margins are very low. Interest rates coming down has hurt them. But the big thing that's hurting them is they and the people who bought their stocks were betting on tax reform. Well, apparently, people are pulling the tax reform bets off the table, saying, no, apparently, tax. And so when we talked earlier about the fact that I am becoming more and more pessimistic that we're going to see tax reform out of this Congress and this president, it's not because we don't want to see tax reform. We'd love to see tax reform. It's because the consensus in the marketplace out there from people collectively who know a lot more than we are, and they're voting with their dollars and saying, you know, I really think we're going to be that Obamacare is going to remain in place and we're not going to get tax reform. But it's a fascinating thing to me. Manufacturing continues to rise in the United States. The Institute for Supply Management's index is notched up again last month. It's been rising steadily for a long time. Employment is, it came out, of course, last week that employment, we're down to 4.3% unemployment.
And we hired fewer people this time around, and it still dropped. And that's a statement. We've been saying this for about a month now. I think we're right at the, or very, very near full employment, which means, you said it last week, there's more job openings than people to fill the jobs in the United States right now. And that's, and it's getting bigger. The difference is getting bigger. At the same time, our trade gap just widened by 5%. That's a big bunch, which means that we're importing more stuff. We're spending more money on imports. Bananas.
Because it's a bunch.
Bunches.
Yes.
Stuff. Bunches of stuff.
Right.
Yes. Bananas are bunches of stuff.
Right.
What this says is that we are picking up trade. Trade's important. If we decided to buy it from another place internally, well, we don't raise a lot of bananas, but there's a lot of other things that we're buying, iPhones, Androids, all kinds of things that are manufactured elsewhere as our wages rise, and they are beginning to rise. There are people that are saying clearly it's not rising as fast as it has in other recessions, but when you look at other recessions, other recoveries from recessions. But if you look at our inflation, and you would revise for inflation, usually the inflation during a recovery is higher than it is in the ones that we've been measuring. So if you look at our recovery, you see that we're right on track, pay for pay, with every other major recovery from a recession if you adjust for inflation. So what that means is our economy is doing extremely well. It just took a long time to slowly ramp up to this speed.
Which tends to happen after financial-based recessions like the one we had. This is the biggie, and I think a lot of people don't understand this. We may have the balance of trade numbers are very artificial.
Yeah.
And we've talked about the fact that if we export a bunch of parts to a border factory right across the border in Mexico where they assemble the car because we don't have enough workers in the United States to assemble the car, and the car comes back, since the car is worth more than the sum of its parts, that is a negative trade balance. And because we exported less than we imported,
wait
theoretically.
Wait, you said the car is worth more than the sum of its parts? You've never had to have a repair job done.
Well, no. Once it gets built, that reverses.
That reverses. The sum of the parts becomes much more valuable than the car at that point.
But The point is that the reason corporate earnings are up about 15% over this time last year, while the economy, the GDP, is growing in low single digits, is because a lot of the earnings from U.S. corporations are generated outside the United States or in trade back and forth across the border. And that accrues to your 401k or your investment portfolio, because as the earnings go up, that value from overseas is accruing in your portfolio. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, I was having a conversation. By the way, I like you guys' show.
You've got something probably medically wrong with you, sir.
You may
have to have that looked
right.
at.
Well, I do have quite a few of those, but I don't think that impinges on my judgment.
Okay.
So here's the question. We were talking the other day about this, several people. What are your take on the, if we get to the place where we completely get rid of cash, the, you know, hard greenbacks and things?
Mm-hmm.
I guess we're not really hard, but we get rid of money as we know it, and we go just strictly electronic currency. What are the pros and cons?
We're almost there now.
I know.
I don't think it'll be any different.
I think the market is dictating it, and this is something that I've been kind of harping on this whole hour. I've got $2 in my pocket, two $1 bills in my wallet, and I've got a stack of credit cards. And the credit cards mean that if I get robbed, I can call my credit card companies, and I don't lose any money. If I walked around with $10,000 in my pocket, which would be absurd in many circumstances, but some people do that,
mm-hmm.
And there are reasons why you might want to do that. If it's taken from you, it's gone forever. And so the market, me, and a lot of other people have said we need to have some method of protecting ourselves from robbery. We also need to have the ability to go across country lines without having to report that we're carrying huge amounts of currency. And when you think about it, if you got a stack of credit cards in your wallet and you go through customs, you don't have to report that you're carrying currency. But if you go across with $10,000, you've got to fill out a thing, and if you don't, they can take the money. There are a lot of issues with an old school method of regulating money that you can skip by getting it electronic. Now, there are still problems on the electronic side. The biggest problem is anonymity disappears. The government can follow up and say, what did you spend money on? On anything eventually. Now, there are people out there that say, well, if you've got nothing to hide, then you shouldn't mind them looking, except that they shouldn't have the right to look unless they have a really strong opinion that you're hiding something. And I don't want the government knowing what I'm spending all the time. That doesn't stop me from using credit cards, though. So that's the negative about going electronic. The other negative is that until we get a system where you can use it when the lights are off, when the power is not running, it's not going to be replaced completely.
That seems to be the biggest concern of the people that I was discussing this with, what happens when the electricity. Now, granted, we don't have nationwide electrical failures, but it would make us extremely vulnerable to one.
Well, now, think about it just a minute. Do you carry enough money in your pocket to go for several days buying gasoline and groceries and paying all your bills or whatever they may be if the power went out?
Not in my pocket.
Well, no. You don't carry it anywhere. No, and the fact is, across the country, we have gone from typically having the money available to pay. People kept their money at home. I remember
And I do recommend this in case of power outages that go for multiple days. I recommend having a safe that's bolted to the floor with some money in it, your emergency money.
Yeah.
I recommend that.
But point
I do have that.
The point is that if you go back a ways, you realize that I well remember when electronic transactions were wire transfers. And you didn't make them unless you had a very, very large dollar amount to transfer. And we gradually have worked our way down to the point where now when you go to buy a sandwich at a fast food joint, you're more likely to use a credit card than you are cash.
I remember being upset at the grocery store when somebody would pull out their credit card because it was going to make the transaction 10 times longer. They had to get their little paper carbon thing that goes grip, grip, back and forth, and then they had to rip off the right paces and it wasn't ripping right, and so they had to do it again, or it went in sideways and destroyed a credit card. And the same was sort of true when somebody wrote a check, but at least that was faster than a credit card. Now it's flipped so that a credit card is faster than cash, and
right.
Convenience is what the market looks for. The next step is the competition brings the price down. The next step after that is maintaining that convenience and power outage, and we'll figure that out at some point.
The difficulty with getting rid of cash at this point is the $100 bill. We could get rid of just about everything else except $1 bills and $100 bills. There are 11.5 billion $100 bills in circulation, and to give you a reference point, there's only 2.8 billion $5 bills in circulation. So what you have is entire nations' economies, including Russia, I might add.
Yes, is running off the $100 bill.
Venezuela, a lot of places that are less than completely stable around the world, they run off of U.S. paper currency because their system doesn't work. So we're not going to get rid of it anytime soon. But I think what you're going to see is practically what Jacob was talking about is going to happen. It is happening, where you really don't need to have cash to function. And eventually we'll get to the point where it, right now it looks a little illicit as soon as you deal in a large amount of cash.
And this is the easiest way to talk to the people that are afraid that they're going to get that the government is just going to come and get rid of all of the currency that's cash form. The penny still exists.
Yes.
It takes a lot to remove a type of currency from circulation. A lot. I mean, it costs more to make a penny than the penny's worth. And a lot of people throw pennies away. They don't even keep them. It's just filling up their pockets. People that are using cash look at the penny and say, what is this for? So keep that in mind. And the people that use cash are not going to go quietly if the government says we're going to remove all of this stuff. I mean, replacing the face on a currency caused political outcry. Alexander Hamilton being removed from a bill caused people to be very upset and caused them to change minds. And now there's a political process to go through to even change the way money looks. So it's a pretty big effort that would have to happen. And we're out of time. I'm sorry for cutting you off, but if you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach us locally at
254-947-1111.
You can email us at jeff or jake at tpwc.com.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.